Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests, with your host, Miriam Raftery.
Welcome, listeners. Today, we're at the World Beat Center in Balboa Park, celebrating the birth of independent media for our region here with KNSJ. Thanks to everyone who helped make our dream become a reality, giving a voice to the people across our region. Now, we've got a great show lined up for this morning. We'll be telling you all about the top fireworks and festivals this 4th of July. And in our first half hour, we have some interviews taped earlier this week from some very special guests, including Congresswoman Susan Davis, bringing us the latest news from Capitol Hill, and El Cajon Councilman Gary Kendrick, who has some good news to share. Assemblyman Brian Jones will be making a special announcement, too. Human rights advocate Estela de los Rios is just back from Washington with the latest on immigration reform. Jeannie Crescenzo from Amicus will tell us about her efforts to help homeless women veterans in East County. Then we'll be back with some live interviews scheduled at 10:30. We'll hear from Lane Sharman and Ty Tosdell with the San Diego Energy Foundation. They'll tell us about their efforts to set up an alternative to SDG&E for consumers. We'll also be talking with Jan Headland about the power of citizen activism and the importance of independent media. We'll tell you about our new show launching next week and introduce you to some of our hosts. But don't go away when today's show is over, because we'll be back on the air at 2 o'clock today with a very special presentation titled The Spirits of 1776, featuring interviews of a lifetime with our founding fathers and our founding mothers. The words they spoke over 200 years ago are as relevant today as they were back when America was born. Our show is going to have a lot of specialty segments. One of those is called Destination East County, and I'm very pleased today to introduce host Arielle Johansson, who's here to tell us all about it and give us some tips on some fun activities today.
Welcome to Destination East County with your host, Arielle Johansson, bringing you the most exciting festivals, events, and attractions each week. Happy 4th of July, everybody! Now, if you're looking for some festive ways to spend your 4th, there's no need to fight those traffic jams and crowds in the beach areas. We have plenty of exciting activities, and yes, fireworks across East County and San Diego's inland regions. If you're in historic Julian or Alpine right now, parades are rolling out in small-town celebrations, complete with bands, bunting, floats, and patriotic entries. El Cajon, which just turned 100 years old, is hosting a centennial picnic at Kennedy Park on East Madison Avenue, complete with musical entertainment starting at 3 p.m., kids' rides, games, crafts, food, and then at 9 o'clock, fireworks. At Old Poway Park, the Battle of Gettysburg will be recreated to commemorate the 150th anniversary of this Civil War milestone. Abraham Lincoln will be making a special guest appearance, delivering his famous Gettysburg Address from the back of the park's historic railway train. Festivities run from 10 to 4 p.m. at Old Poway Park, which also has live music, train rides, mock train robberies, free crafts and games for kids, and more, all at historic Old Poway Park. Poway also hosts a fireworks display at 9 p.m. at Poway High School. Ramona also has a celebration from 5 to 9 p.m. tonight at Olive Pierce Middle School, finishing off with a fireworks display. One of the most dazzling fireworks displays will be held at the Santee Salutes Festival at Town Center Community Park East. The park will be rocking from 3:30 to 9:30 p.m. with live rock and roll music, inflatable jumps for kids, food trucks, a patriotic ceremony, and the highlight of the evening, the fireworks show at 9. Get details on all these events and more at www.eastcountymagazine.org. Be sure to tune in starting next week to hear the new East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting in Descanso from the deserts to the coast. Our show will be on every weekday from 5 to 6 p.m., and we'll have lots of special features, including Destination East County, bringing the very best festivals, events, and activities each week in our region. See you around East County.
Thank you, Arielle. And we've got some late-breaking news that the A-House is going to be having Independence Day celebrations all weekend long, including fireworks tonight and a showing of the movie Independence Day, some live music, and another show featuring rock and roll music by some of the icons of the industry. You can get all those details at our website, www.eastcountymagazine.org. Now, stay tuned. Coming up next, we've got some interviews with several top newsmakers who couldn't be here today, but they wanted to join in our Independence Day celebration. Now, straight from the headlines, we bring you the latest top newsmakers. As we celebrate Independence Day here in San Diego, there are plenty of fireworks going on in our nation's capital. Congresswoman Susan Davis, whose district now includes much of East County as well as San Diego, joins us to talk about an important issue that will impact many families and students across our region and the nation. Welcome to KNSJ and East County Magazine, Congresswoman Davis.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Appreciate this time.
Now, one of the hottest topics on Capitol Hill right now is the battle over student loan rates, which doubled on July 1st because Congress failed to pass legislation to continue them. The rates jumped from 3.4% to a whopping 6.8%. But there's still time to fix that, and Congresswoman Davis is co-sponsoring a bill, H.R. 1433. Can you please tell us about the measure?
I'm very hopeful that we can come back on July 10th, the Senate can come back, and that we can take another look at this. What our students are faced with in doubling the interest rates is something that I don't think had to happen at all. The Senate is now looking at a bill that would at least extend the student loan rates for another year at 3.4%.
The Republican majority in the House of Representatives has a different idea of what to do about this problem. I understand they've passed a measure by John Klein of Minnesota, and you voted against it. What was their plan?
Yes, I voted against it because that plan basically would attach student loan rates to a variable rate. Now, we know that you can come in at one rate and it can change pretty dramatically. What I wanted to know, and I actually had a piece, an amendment that would have asked the CBO,
Congressional Budget Office,
to state very clearly what that could mean to students. My congressional colleagues on the Republican side wanted to increase those interest rates to whatever they might be in the future.
According to the Congressional Budget Office, we looked it up, and it could be 7.7%.
That's right.
That's a lot of money for college students.
That's a lot of money. And the sad thing about this is, and why we fought so hard against this particular measure, is that I don't believe that the government needs to put this on the backs of our students. It would have been a contribution in some ways to the deficit to as much as $4 billion. Well, that tells you that students would be paying far more than they would need to pay those student loans.
And in fact, we have some numbers on that also. Again, according to the Congressional Research Service, which is a nonpartisan organization, students who get the maximum loan for 4 years of college would be paying $8,331 in interest alone under the Republican plan, but only $3,450 under the plan that Congresswoman Davis is supporting. And if Congress does nothing and this doubling of rates stay in place, hang on, kids, it's going to cost you $7,284 in interest for those same four-year loans.
That was not acceptable to those of us on the Democratic side. And we were hopeful that we could, with a bill that was offered on our side, to extend for 2 years the 3.4% rates so that we have time to really look at this and see maybe there are some incentives that we can provide for universities to even look at their tuition rates as it relates to interest rates for our students. The other thing that's complicated here is that parents also take out loans, and their rates also would increase. So if you add the student rate and the parent rate under the Republican plan, we could be looking at thousands of dollars that would have to be paid over the course of a student's.
Now, we should say the Republican rationale for this is they were trying to reduce the nation's debt. But basically, it's on the backs of the young people of the day who are going to come out with even higher debts. As a parent of two recent college graduates, I know firsthand how difficult this can be. The tuitions at the University of California quadrupled just from the time my oldest began high school to the time he graduated from college, and went up even more by the time our youngest was through. So I've done a little research, and I found out that even after we adjust for inflation, California State University students and their families are paying three times more today than they did back in 1992, and the average CSU student is graduating with almost $15,000 in debt, while the average UC student is saddled with over $17,000. Tuition and fees alone are about $6,000 now at the CSU campuses, not counting living expenses or books. And at UC, the average cost, with all those expenses factored in, is a staggering $36,000 a year. That's $118,000 to put one student through a four-year education if they're living away from home.
That's a lot of money. And what we know is that that really impacts students' ability to move forward with their lives. It means that they're, in many cases, may not even entertain getting married. They may take the job that they don't necessarily want, but something that they think can help them pay their loans back. They certainly aren't going to be interested in purchasing a home. Things that many of us thought were possible when we went to school, and we knew that there were great benefits from going to college. There still are great benefits today. Yeah. Every student, I think, should know that they will be much more able to do the things that they want to do in life with a full college education and then beyond if they choose. But I think that this decision about going to school really is built often on whether or not it's affordable for them and for their family. And we don't want students to be held back. There was a time, certainly in California here, and I know because I had that opportunity as well, to really believe that the state was investing in me because they knew that if they did that, I would go on and contribute and I would be a tax-paying member of the community and I would be able to go on and do things that were helpful.
It's worth noting here on Independence Day that Thomas Jefferson, who authored the Declaration of Independence, also believed strongly that education should be free to all deserving students. He said, "The most promising genius whose parents are too poor to give them further education should be carried at the public expense through the college and university. The object is to bring into action that mass of talents which lie buried in poverty, and thus give activity to a mass of mind." Do you think, Congresswoman, that a college education should be a right for all students who have high grades and have worked hard, regardless of whether their families are rich or poor or middle class?
I think we need to provide the tools for every family to put together a package that works for them. And that means that there will be some scholarship money. I think families want to contribute what they can, and certainly loans are a part of that. But we need to do what we can at the federal government, I believe, to make certain that the interest on those loans is not something that really makes such a difference that students would not be able to go forward. Clearly, the interest rates alone are not a determining factor. But if you double them, as we're seeing today, that's not helpful. And again, it tells us that the government is trying on the backs of students to address this deficit. That there are many, many ways of doing that. And in fact, even today with the sequestration, which I don't think is a good idea, we are addressing some of the deficit and we can do more. But it is very important that we send that clear message to students that they are an investment in the future, and we need to do everything that we can to continue to send that message.
Very good. Now, there is another student loan scandal brewing. This week, Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts revealed that Sallie Mae, the nation's largest student lender, has been taking low-rate, taxpayer-backed student loans from a federal bank, and then using that money to fund extremely expensive private loans to students. She is accusing Sallie Mae and the Federal Housing Finance Authority of taking advantage of taxpayers to rake in big fees from students who borrow money from the government to fund their education. These loans will make a profit of $184 billion over the next years, all off students, 14 cents on every dollar. Now, Senator Warren asked an interesting question. She says, why are these loans called subsidized if they're making such a profit? And she called the findings deeply troubling.
Are you concerned about that, and do you think something should be done?
Well, that goes back to what we've been talking about, because if it's $4 billion in deficit that an increased student loan is going to be, then that tells us that the government is really making an awfully lot of money off of the students. The reason that we wanted to extend for 2 years and even 1 year would be helpful is to give us a chance to really look at the implications of all of this. And if there are some bad actors in this situation, then we want to be able to address those as well. I think that the Congress right now, we've had a lot of focus on some other issues, but this one is really important. And we want to give ourselves the chance to really look at all these issues together.
It should be noted for those who live in other districts that San Diego's congressional delegation was not a complete partisan divide on this. Congresswoman Davis and Congressman Juan Vargas both voted no on this Republican measure, and they're both Democrats. And Democrat Scott Peters, however, joined with Republicans Daryl Issa and Duncan Hunter in voting for the measure. Let's end by just asking, what can listeners do if they're concerned about this on either side of this issue and they want to voice their views?
We want to hear from them. And I know that I've actually been in press conferences with Mr. Peters, and certainly he's an advocate for that. There were some very specific things about that particular bill that he voted that way. I love hearing from students who are telling me what their particular situations are, because then we can really put a story and a face together on an issue like this. It impacts our kids, and it definitely impacts our parents. So the more we know, the better we're off in trying to understand this issue.
Well, we will look forward to hearing back from you after the 10th to find out what happens with this very important bill. And thank you so much for joining us on KNSJ to help us celebrate the birth of independent media.
It's my pleasure, Miriam, to be with you today. Thank you.
Hello, this is Assemblyman Brian Jones. Our state is home to some of our nation's most beautiful parks and beaches, diverse landscapes and plants, gorgeous sunsets and breathtaking sunrises. It is rich because of its rivers, deserts, mountain ranges, and great valleys. I'm proud to represent Eastern San Diego County and Southern Riverside County, home of some of these gorgeous landscapes. Together with East County Magazine, I am pleased to announce that we will be hosting a photography contest featuring your pictures of San Diego's East County and Southern Riverside County. It's an honor to be able to highlight the photographers and the beautiful landscapes these counties have to offer. The winning photographs will be displayed in my Capitol office and featured in East County Magazine. So submit your photos today. For more information, please visit eastcountymagazine.com or call my office at 916-319-2071. All entries must be received by July 15th at 5 p.m. This is Assemblyman Brian Jones.
This is Miriam Raftery, and on this Independence Day weekend, I'm here today with El Cajon Councilman Gary Kendrick, here to share some very exciting news with us. Welcome, Gary.
Thank you, Miriam.
Tell us the big news.
July 9th, we're having a city council meeting where we're going to discuss reopening the East County Performing Arts Center.
The theater now has been closed for, about 3 years, 4 years now?
About 4 years now.
Now, I understand that there's been a preliminary vote taken on this, and can you tell us about that?
The city council voted by a 5-0 vote to set aside $2.8 million to refurbish and run the East County Performing Arts Center.
That is a good chunk of change. Now, that's quite a change from just a year ago when the economy was down and the council was hearing a proposal from a developer who at that time was wanting to tear the theater down completely and put a hotel up on the site. Council voted against that option. Can you tell us what's changed?
The economy has changed. The city ended this year with a $4.5 million surplus.
Well, that's good news.
And it is very good news. We're out of the Great Recession. A few years ago, we had to make a very tough decision. That was to provide city services such as police or fire, or to keep the theater open. Mm-hmm. And we decided that providing police and fire services had to trump the theater at the time. Things have changed now. We've got much more money available, and it's time to reopen the jewel of the East County.
Well, we're looking forward to that. Now, tell us a few of the details. Who's going to manage the theater, and what kind of programming do you think we might be seeing there?
We will definitely hire a professional manager. We had a professional manager several years ago. We're looking for a manager that has the unique ability to be able to have the connections in the industry. Many times there may be a headliner that has a show in Palm Springs and then 2 weeks later has a show in Los Angeles, and they have 1 weekend of downtime. We were able to, last time, get the headliner to come in at half the price, and we can pass on the savings to our patrons and fill up the theater.
Now, the $2.8 million, I understand that includes bringing it up to ADA, Americans with Disabilities Act compliance, taking care of the leaking roof. Is it repairing or replacing the roof, Gary?
Well, this will be a major repair of the roof. We could do a minor repair for much less money, but then we realized that in 2 years, we'd have to do a major repair of the roof anyways, and we don't want to have to shut down the theater for 6 months. We want to get it up and running, and it's very important that this theater is filled as much to capacity as often as we can do it.
Councilman, what would you say to those who suggest this could be done for less money?
I don't want to have just a good theater. I want to have a great theater, and it takes money to make a great theater.
How does voting to invest in the arts square with your fiscal conservative views?
I believe investing in the arts is good business for the city. A few years ago, I got up in front of 16 different performances of Traditions of Christmas, and I asked the patrons to show the impact of the theater on local businesses. And
How did you do that?
Well, I asked them to buy $2 bills from us. We had $15,000 worth of $2 bills that we received directly from the Federal Reserve. I got up in front and said, please buy these $2 bills from us and spend them locally. We want to show the impact that the theater patrons have on the local economy.
Well, that must be good for the merchants, the restaurants, and the businesses downtown, and I guess ultimately for the city coffers and the taxpayers.
Actually, we had amazing results. Businesses were calling us and saying, we have thousands of dollars of $2 bills in our cash registers. Keep it coming. So we proved beyond a reasonable doubt that theater is good business for the economy.
Now, Gary, a theater also brings intangible benefits to a community.
That's absolutely correct. The theater enhances the quality of life of the community, and it brings people from outside of El Cajon to the city core.
There are also benefits for the children of El Cajon and all of East County.
Absolutely. With my children being in theater, I saw that it kept a lot of kids out of trouble. If they're in a theater play, they're not out doing something bad.
It helps them build public speaking and confidence in front of an audience, and it's really a skill that can be valuable all through life, I think.
That's correct. It gives them incredible amount of self-confidence to perform in front of 1,000 people. My son was in several performances at the Performing Arts Center, and at the age of 8, he went on to sing in front of 500 people on the Midway.
Wow, and he got his start out right out here in El Cajon at the Performing Arts Center.
That's right.
Amazing.
And my older son, because of his experience in theater, he is now a successful producer's assistant writing and editing scripts.
So he made it all the way to Hollywood?
That's right. He's very happy at what he does, and the Performing Arts Center had a direct impact on his success.
Well, he has a very proud papa, we can see here. Perhaps we should add that no theater anywhere of this size has been successful completely on its own. It typically requires some investment from the local community.
That's absolutely correct. There is no theater that I know of that does not operate without a subsidy. We subsidize the recreation center, and a theater is no different than a recreation center. It's just a different part of the arts. I know that we will have to subsidize this theater $300,000 or $400,000 a year for a long, long time, and that's fine because I believe it will pay us back in great dividends.
Very good. Now, that meeting again, there's going to be a report coming out.
Well, the meeting is on July 9th at 3:00 at the El Cajon City Council Chambers, and I would encourage everyone that's interested in the Performing Arts Center and the arts to come to the meeting and give us your ideas. I really need to hear the public and what they have to say because there are a lot of good ideas that come out of the public. The report will be available online at the City of El Cajon website on July 5th.
Very good. Well, one of the important things about having independent media that's devoted to East County issues is the ability to get the word out about important community issues like this so that you listeners will know what's going on at your local councils and can come voice your opinions. Gary, I, for one, am really looking forward to the reopening. I've been a big fan of the theater for many years. In fact, my daughter, a little bit of trivia, she once skated on tech ice on that stage when she was just a little kid.
The theater has a lot of great memories for me because I have three boys, and all three of them performed in shows at the theater. So I have great memories of that theater, and we've had great headliners there. And many times you go to the theater, and it is absolute magic. I'm looking forward to that again.
I am too. I'm ready to grab my popcorn and be there in the front row when the curtains go up at the East County Performing Arts Center. How soon do we anticipate that it will actually be open?
Our goal is to open the theater in the summer of 2014.
Very good. Gary, thank you so much for joining us here on KNSJ 89.1 FM on this 4th of July week.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
My next guest is Estela de los Rios. Estela is the executive director of CSA San Diego, a nonprofit in East County that addresses civil and human rights for the last 45 years. She's also an advocate for immigrant rights on a national level. Welcome, Estela.
Thank you very much for the invitation. It's very good to be here.
Now, I understand you just returned from Washington, D.C. Can you tell us the latest on the immigration bill?
Yes, I had the honor of going to D.C. in the week that immigration was at the core of bringing it into the Senate for the hearing. And when I left, I believe it had just been passed, and now it's getting into the House of Representatives. And that's going to be our challenge in the House of Representatives. Right now, people are organizing for July 9th so that we can call in and encourage our House of Representatives to vote for this passage of the immigration bill.
What are the pros and the cons of the immigration bill as it stands now from your point of view?
The pros of this immigration bill, for many years working on this comprehensive reform, finally, it's going to be a period of 10 years where a family, immediate family only, mother, father, siblings, can have a process where it will lead to a pathway to citizenship. And also, they will be able to reunite with their families. Some of these families have not seen their mothers or fathers or loved ones for many years, 15, 20, 25 years. Imagine not seeing your mom for that many years, but now they can rest and finally travel across to their country and come back and be reassured that they're not going to be living in the shadows anymore. Also, just knowing that you will have a voice in this nation, all the hard work that has taken so many years to accomplish. Those are the pros.
And what are the cons?
The cons are, there's, in order to receive that comprehensive reform, it had to be negotiated with the Republicans. And that renegotiation was border security. Billions of dollars wasted on border security, where that money could be towards education and right now towards health. Our economy is already in a crisis. And adding this is even more of a burden to our economy.
What would you say to those who object to legalization because they believe it could be a drain on the economy?
I believe that it's not a drain on the economy. If they do their homework and check into the stats of this country, millions of immigrants have fed into the Social Security system, for example. Those monies will never be seen by all the immigrants that have contributed in the past years because of their status here. They're unable to file income tax, and all those taxes have gone to our Social Security system. So they're not a drain. In fact, it's an asset, because now we have that. And nationally, an economist has reported that it will make a positive impact if we have an immigration reform.
Back to border security for a moment. What would you say to those who contend that we need stronger border security?
My question would be, how much stronger? In the history of this nation, there has never been the highest deportation rate since Obama's been in office. Us Latinos have advocated that the security has caused a lot of border deaths in these past year, has caused a lot of deportations. Families have been sacrificing their lives, and it's just been as high as it can be. So we believe that border security is not an answer to comprehensive reform.
Can you put a human face on this for us? Some of the clients, perhaps people you've worked with, how is this bill going to impact their lives?
That's a very good question. I believe everyone in our community knows of a family that this is going to impact. We have dreamers that come to us that have master's degrees and have bachelor's degrees, young people that don't even know what Mexico looks like, have never been to Mexico, and in some instances, they don't know any other country besides here where we live now. to understand that they're not welcome in their own place of where they've been educated, where they've gone to school, where they've known family and friends and known the school system. This is sad. I want to quote what Vice President Biden recently said at this Hispanic prayer breakfast that I attended. He said, "These children are not children of immigrants. These children are the children of our nation, and we need to protect them as much as we protect all the children of this nation."
You've met with both leaders in the Democratic and the Republican Party while you were back in Washington. Can you give us any insights into that?
Yes. When I say we, were about 20,000 leaders in Washington, D.C., doing legislative visits at the Capitol. And this time it was very different and unique. We were able to meet with 222 Republicans in a committee meeting to let them know that Hispanics, Latinos are watching their voice and their support, because Latinos are voting now. The statistics show that 18-year-olds are turning 18 every, I don't know how many seconds, but the majority of them are Latino. So it's very important that they understand that they need to support a comprehensive immigration reform. And we were there to meet with them to let them know what the principles of an immigration reform bill was. Not border security, but a reform that is just and fair and gives comprehensive solution, not just a negotiation.
What are your final thoughts here for listeners today on KNSJ?
While the final outcome of the push for immigration reform remains uncertain, everyone that's committed to justice, equality, and the respect of basic human rights must be clear that there's a lot of work ahead of us. With or without legislation this year, in particular, immigrant communities across the nation will have to find the wisdom, the courage, to address the dual challenges of getting the most benefit of any changes to the immigration law that may be enacted this year, while at the same time much better organized to right all the wrongs that the current proposed changes will leave unaddressed.
How important is independent media to the Latino community, Estella?
The messaging will change, because right now we are in need of a voice, and that need will be met with independent media, because we will now have voice to that community that we represent and that reflects our demographic changes here in East County.
Thank you so much for joining us today on this Independence Day with KNSJ.
And congratulations to you again. Thank you very much.
This Independence Day, one thing many of us take for granted is having a safe place to call home. In this economy, far too many people have fallen between the cracks, winding up homeless, including many women veterans. This can have tragic consequences for people such as Michelle St. Clair, a homeless woman veteran who died when a brush fire swept through the camp in Lakeside where she was living recently. Today, I'm here with Jeannie Crescenzo, who is an advocate for the homeless, and she started an organization called Amicus, a nonprofit that is working to help homeless people. Welcome, Jeannie.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
Recently, we've had some changes in the county, at least in the city of San Diego, to help the homeless. Can you tell us a little bit about what's happening over there?
Well, fortunately, we have a new mayor and people on the city council who are much more compassionate about the situation of homeless people. And so the new budget that was just passed leaves the winter shelter open year-round, and also the veterans' tent. It's also got money for public restrooms 24/7. And funding for a check-in center where homeless people can leave their belongings. And money is arranged so that the Neil Good Day Center is taken care of.
And this was under the leadership of Mayor Filner, Bob Filner, who, of course, formerly chaired the Veterans Affairs Committee in Congress. But for homeless people in East County, the situation is very different. Tell us about that.
Well, there's really no place for homeless people in the county to go for emergency shelter. We don't have a county-run emergency shelter. We have the Interfaith Shelter Network that gets some funding from the county. But these are churches, and people have to rotate through them.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have been explaining to me that you're finding that a lot of women veterans are falling between the cracks, and that it's easier for some type of homeless people to get help than others. Tell us what some of the problems are that you've identified.
Well, I get calls every day from women, mostly veterans. They find out about us through 211 and Courage to Call and the VA. They fall into two main categories. We have older women who don't even realize that they can get benefits from having served. And who are in situations in their life now where they're not working, they can't afford housing, maybe they have some health problems, their families have moved away. And then the other category, which is growing, it's just unconscionable how fast it's growing, is women veterans who are recent veterans. They're coming from Iraq and Afghanistan.
And this is truly a new phenomenon, isn't it, to have so many young women who are homeless, especially veterans?
Yeah, well, typically it took Vietnam veterans about 10 years to go from being discharged to becoming homeless. We're seeing it almost immediate now in both male and female veterans. But female veterans have a particular problem because many of them are being discharged with other than honorable discharge status rather than honorable.
And why is that happening?
Because they've been sexually assaulted. And if they report it, this is the way the military gets rid of them, makes the problem go away. And it sends a message to these women, don't report it, don't make a big stink.
So they've been victimized once,
yes,
and then they come here and
they're
this makes everything hard.
Repeatedly by the system.
Now, there's a stereotype out there that many of the homeless have issues such as substance abuse. To what degree are you seeing that in these women that you were trying to help, Jeannie?
The women that we're helping do not have substance abuse problems. There are many services out there for people who have substance abuse problems. So we're almost punishing people, the moms who take the responsibility for taking care of their kids, can't get a job, can't afford the rental prices, which are out of this world, and they have no place to go.
So your efforts are to help these women who've done nothing wrong other than just
trying to make it.
Right. Tell us about Amicus and these homeless group homes that you have, where they are, how people can get help, what services you offer them.
Right now, we just have one home, and that's group housing. With group housing, our costs for per person per night are extremely low, and we've proven that it works. So you take a single family home in a low-middle income house neighborhood, and we can put up to 6 unrelated adults in that house without going for permits and zoning and all that.
And beyond the roof over their heads, do you offer them additional types of help?
There's so many services out there that are already connected to provide those services. So what we can do is bring those services into Amicus House or refer our women to those services.
So you help them find services they might not know about,
yes,
that are out there for them. Now, I understand you're looking to start 4 more group homes for the homeless people, including one here in East County.
That's our plan. By December of 2014, we hope to have 5 houses in operation, and one in North County, one in East County, one in Southeast San Diego, and probably another one in downtown.
What do you need to make that happen?
Oh, lots of money. We are not going for
your
VA
nonprofit
funding,
we should mention,
right.
You can accept donations.
And we do ask our women to pay rent, but it's a very low, affordable rent. We need that to sustain.
Do you have the properties already?
We're looking for rentals or to purchase property that it's going to cost us very, very little and no down payment. So if we can get an REO deeply discounted, our monthly payment would be no more than a rental payment. So we're looking for a 4-bedroom, 2 or 2.5 bathroom in middle-income neighborhoods, low-middle-income neighborhoods.
What are some of the success stories you have? How has this helped the women who have been into the home that you already have?
Oh, it's night and day. We have one gal there who was living in for a year in Balboa Park. This is a veteran. This is someone who served our country. Someone who, because of being raped in the military, does not have a honorable discharge. So we've brought her into the house. She's doing fabulous. We're working with her to get her status upgraded so that she can get the benefits she needs. And hopefully she'll go on and be able to get a job and be on her own.
Well, very good. And you also help people find job training or education if that's
what they
need?
Well, we work very closely with a lot of other organizations, including Able Disabled Advocacy, that works with our veterans.
Where can people get more information if they want to help or they want to get involved?
They can go to our website, amicus.org, and that's amikas.org, or they can give me a call, 619-822-2000. 2782.
Well, very good, Jeannie. Thanks so much for joining us on this celebration of independent media on Independence Day here in San Diego.
Thank you.